The Tragedy of Cinema podcast is intended as a family-friendly program that by extension strives to be inclusive to all people regardless of their ethnicity, gender, creed, or any other identifying factors in this incredibly diverse world of ours. With that said, some of the films we discuss may contain serious subject matters or have content considered morally objectionable by today's standards. We do not intend to condone or dismiss these aspects of these films, but our primary focus will be on what we believe the film succeeds at, some fun facts, and our personal enjoyment factors of each film. With that said, we hope you enjoy the show.
Has been away too long. And now at last, he's come home.
The men fought at Valley Forge.
Daddy, come back safe.
Home to the childhood memories, to the old familiar faces, to a life unmolested by time.
And with your saints, let him rejoice in your presence forever. We ask it through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Home to Salem's Lot, a town too good to be true.
Did you happen to notice the time when the boys left?
We shouldn't have gone through the woods.
It's a shortcut.
Then they should have been here half an hour ago.
Wait, Danny, wait!
Something is happening. Something terrible.
Henry! Where's Ralphie?
Ralph. Where's your brother?
Just a kid disappears and this. You're not leaving Salem's Lot, are you?
I'm not leaving. Don't you understand what's happening?
You?
Yes, I do. It's in the Marston house.
Good evening.
I dreamed.
You slept there all night?
Yeah. A little tired. Didn't sleep much last night. I was dreaming.
Somebody out there.
Sweet. Sweet dreams.
I let him in.
Well, it's only all just happened since...
Since I came here.
It wasn't a dream.
Nothing against the master.
They're breeding on one another. The vampires are creating vampires.
The master wants you.
It's a geometric progression. 2 × 2 × 4 × 8.
There's a dead man upstairs.
Bill!
Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
Look at me.
Ned Tebbett's body has disappeared from the morgue.
Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
Bill!
Ben, Susan's in there. Run, no! Look at him.
Stephen King, the best-selling author of Carrie and The Shining, takes you on a startling journey. To Salem's Lot.
All right, guys, welcome back once again to the Tragedy of Cinema podcast. I'm your host, Jimbo.
And I'm your co-host, Kyle.
Kyle, today we were doing the miniseries that I picked, Salem's Lot, from 1979. I was a whopping 2-year-old little boy.
Maybe I was not born.
You weren't even a... Your parents might not even been born.
My parents were born at that point, but even they were...
They were young.
I don't think my dad was even 18 yet.
Wow. So this is the first time that I've stated that we've done a TV miniseries as an episode. And not only that, but it's a Stephen King one. Kyle, when I was in high school, I remember there were several miniseries that came out, which would be like a Monday or Tuesday, or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It would break it up into like five different chunks, days that you had to watch it. And I remember one of them definitely was The Stand. I love that movie with Gary Sinise and Molly Ringwald and all of them. It's a Stephen King one. Also, I remember Tommyknockers was one. So there was different ones of that era. Now it's just, hey, let me point and click and you get it.
But, yeah.
But that was all the rage of high school where you could sit there and we'd talk about it. But before we get started, Kyle, what's your favorite Stephen King movie? Or miniseries.
I really don't watch many of them. I've never really been a big like Stephen King fan. Like I love it, but at the same time, it's like, eh.
Oh, so it.
Yeah, no.
You said I love it.
Oh, you very funny. Yeah, but it'd probably be Kubrick's Shining, which I know Stephen King largely hates.
Right.
But then again, I think it's only because like Stanley Kubrick made an alcoholic be a bad guy. Stephen King was like, no, that's too much like me. Wow. Sorry, that's too dark.
Mr. King, please direct all your lawsuits to Kyle Zahner.
No. But I like Stephen King just fine. He's fine. He's a great writer.
Have you ever read one of his books?
No,
there's no pictures of him.
I read frequently enough.
You do Audible. That doesn't count as reading.
I do real books too. I do.
Oh,
yeah,
do you?
I do.
What's the last real book you read?
Last real book I read, In the Name of the King by Patrick Rufus. I tried reading that through. I didn't finish it. I got like three quarters of the way through and I kind of got tired of it. Fantasy is kind of a tough genre.
So
sometimes.
What's the last one that you finished?
Probably Gears of War book. The last one that was released. I think it was not just sent as a remnant, but it was one of the Gears of War books. The last one that came out. Was it New Ephira? Maybe that was it was. I don't remember. But it was a Gears of War book from the Gears of War games because I like reading those books. But yeah, I just go through those and they're dumb schlock, but I enjoy them a lot.
All right, Kyle, go ahead and let's take away Salem's Lot.
All right, Jimbo, no problem. What was the last book you read, Jimbo, actually?
The Bible.
That's a cheat. Everyone reads the Bible.
Okay. No, but I think the last one that I finished was the autobiography of Katharine Hepburn. I think it's entitled Me.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty good.
Nice. Okay. That's pretty cool. It's going to be worth waiting. But yeah. Anyways, that's my feedback. That's my counter question to you. Yeah. Now back to the actual film or miniseries. I was using it as a film, but no, it's a miniseries.
And just so you know, Kyle, the original book for this had an apostrophe in front of the S of Salem's Lot because it's technically Jerusalem's Lot is the name of the thing.
Interesting. City, so. It makes sense during the story, I guess. Yeah. Okay, so Salem's Lot here released, the first episode released on November 17th, 1979, and included in the same year, follows the story of a young novelist and horror fan in an attempt to save a small New England town which has been invaded by vampires. Dun, dun, dun. This film was directed by Toby Hooper. Writers include, of course, Stephen King for the original novel and Paul Menish for the screenplay adaptation. Produced by Richard Corbett's. Composed by Harry Suckman, and cinematography was Julius Brenner. Some of the awards for the film, we have four nominations for three of which were Primetime Emmys, and one was an Edgar Allan Poe Award. In 1980, it was nominated for the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Television Feature or Miniseries. And then for the Primetime Emmy nominations, we have nominations for Outstanding Achievement in Music Composition for a Limited Series or a Special, Outstanding Achievement in Graphic Design and Title Sequence, and Outstanding Achievement in Makeup. Total runtime for the movie is 200 minutes for the entire series. I don't know how they actually divided up those little chunks necessarily for the original release for the television run, but 200 minutes in total, so that makes it around 3 hours basically for the entire production. More than 3 hours even, wow. So very long program if you watched it, the movie like I did. Sound mix is a mono auto recording, so just a single track audio recording. Color info, this is a color info. Color. This is a color film. Sorry. There we go. Dyslexic mind abound. Aspect ratio is 1.33:1, or the standard television aspect ratio for the time. But there's also a 1.85:1 theatrical cut for the ratio overall. And now we're going to move on to the cast of the film. Pretty lengthy here, so I'm going to keep it kind of brisk for actor per movie. So we're going to go through that here. But we have David Soule playing the role of Ben Mears. David Soule was, of course, Hutch in the original Starsky and Hutch series from 1975 to 1979. So that very long makes him probably, that's easily his most recognizable role.
Of course.
Yeah. And, of course, he also appeared in the Starsky and Hutch film 2004 when he basically reprised his role as Hutch from the original series.
I didn't watch it. Is it like they did like Dukes of Hazzard where they made it like a comedy?
Yeah. I don't know which one is worse, though, the Dukes of Hazzard film or that Starsky and Hutch film.
Oh.
But, man, I don't feel like they really did a proper tribute to either one of those series.
Or even the Brady Bunch. They just totally just...
Yeah, it was... Something was off of those films. There was a weird decade for those kind of reboots, kind of film things going on there. Hopefully they don't continue doing that kind of stuff. But he was also, of course, in the Magnum Force. Was in the movie, Clint Eastwood movie, where he played one of the dirty cops, I believe. And next up, we have James Mason playing the role of Richard K. Straker. James Mason was also in the film Lolita in 1962 and A Star is Born in 1954. Next up, we have Lance Kerwin playing the role of Mark Petrie. Lance Kerwin was also in the film Outbreak in 1995, that like a viral outbreak film that got reshown like 20 times a day during COVID, every single day of the year, it felt like. And he was also in the film Enemy Mine in 1985.
I haven't watched that in a long time.
I haven't seen it. What's it about?
It's a sci-fi movie.
Oh, sci-fi movie?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. I'll check it out sometime. Then next up, we have Bonnie Bedelia playing the role of Susan Norton. Bonnie Bedelia was also known as, what was the character's name in the Die Hard film? She was
Holly.
Holly in Die Hard 1 and 2 in 1988 and 1990, respectively.
Not a Christmas movie.
The only Christmas movie, Jimbo. That's what I was saying. It's the only Christmas movie. Every other Christmas movie, not a Christmas movie. Just Die Hard. Next up, we have Lou Ayres playing the role of Jason Burke. Lou was also in the film Holiday in 1938. Next up, we got Julia Cobb playing the role of Bonnie Sawyer. Julia Cobb was also in the film Star Trek maybe that's the original series, 1966. Sometimes isn't the same between TV and movies here. But we have Star Trek in 1966, and I don't know if that's the original film or the television show. So I have to clarify that maybe later. Next up, we have Alicia Cook Jr. playing the role of Gordon Wesley Phillips. No, Gordon Weasel Phillips. Sorry, Weasel is the nickname in the film. Alicia Cook Jr. was also in the film House on Haunted Hill in 1959.
Do you remember when we covered that?
Yeah, it's been a while.
He's the guy at the very beginning that his face superimposes on the screen. And he's like, "You're not going to believe this story."
Oh, yeah. So basically, kind of like the opening narrator kind of deal. Awesome.
And I think he's in the movie later on, but I mean, that's.
Yeah, I think he has a few lines that I want to be in too.
Yeah.
No, oh, that's very cool. Next up, we have George
Costanza.
Oh, okay. No, George Costanza. Sorry, I thought you were correcting me. Jimbo.
I didn't know Seinfeld was in there.
Don't interrupt me while I'm casting.
There's vampires in this movie.
Exactly. I was in Crimson Tide. 1995. George Dizunda. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his wrong name probably, but he played the role of Cully Sawyer. George was also in the film Crimson Tide in 1995. Then next up, we have Clarissa Kane Mason. Clarissa was playing the role of Majora Glick. Clarissa was also in the film Ned Kelly in 1970. Then we have Jeffrey Lewis playing the role of Mike Ryerson. Jeffrey Lewis was also in the film The Way of the Gun in the year 2000. Next up, we have Barney McFadden playing the role of Ned Tibbetts. Ned Tibbetts. Barney was also in the film The Awakening Land in 1978. Then next up, we have Kenneth MacKillan playing the role of the Constable Parkins Gillespie. Kenneth was also in the film Dune in 1984, the original Dune, not the new films, not the Paul Villeneuve films. And then next up, we have Fred Willard playing the role of Larry Crockett. Fred Willard was also in the film Best in Show in the year 2000. Next up, we have Maria Windsor playing the role of Eva Miller. Maria Windsor was also in the film The Killing in 1956. Then we have Barbara Babcock playing the role of June Petrie. Barbara was also in the film Far and Away in 1992. Then we have the actor Bonnie Bartlett playing the role of Anne Norton. Bonnie Bartlett was also in the film St. Elsewhere in 1982. Then we have Joshua Bryant playing the role of Ted Petrie. Joshua Bryant was also in the film Night Gallery in 1969. Then we have James Gallery playing the role of Father Donald Callahan. James Gallery was also in the film Mr. Mom in 1983.
One of my favorite movies.
One of Jimbo's favorite films, I was about to say. And we also have Robert Lussery playing the role of Deputy Constable Nellie Gardner, who was also in the film Mr. Mom in 1983. Wow. I heard that's one of Jimbo's favorite films.
did we ever cover that, Kyle?
We still haven't covered Mr. Mom yet. I don't think we have.
Oh, yeah, we will.
We will. Don't you worry.
Have you ever seen it?
No, I don't think I have.
Oh,
I never sat through it since I was a kid easily. I'm sure.
Oh, man, it's great.
Like, I know what it's about. I know like the story, but
it's great.
Yeah, I haven't like sat down and watched it. Next up, we got Brad Savage playing the role of Danny Glick. Brad Savage was also in the film Red Dawn in 1984. Excellent film. Then next up, we have Ronnie Scribner playing the role of Ralphie Glick. Ronnie Scribner was also in the film Split Image in 1982.
How creepy are those two boys in this movie?
Very creepy, Jimbo. Very creepy. Then we have Ned Wilson playing the role of Henry Glick. Ned Wilson was also in the film Being There in 1979. And then finally, we have Richard Nalder playing the role of Kurt Barlow, who's uncredited in this film. Richard Nalder was also in the film The Man Who Knew Too Much in 1956. And that concludes the cast of Salem's Lot.
Whew. You all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
Take a breath.
Yeah. I feel like I was surprised, actually. I feel like I mispronounced a lot of those names.
You know, you probably mispronounced more of those than you did last episode of Godzilla names.
After Godzilla, I was expecting like an easy, clean cut break. And then as I got further on the list, I was like, wait a minute, I'm not sure about this one. That's how I got George Costanza. Anyways, moving on, Jimbo. Let's go talk about some cool trivia going on here and the film itself.
Yeah, so let's talk about a little bit about the since there's only a little bit of notes. Let's talk about a little overview of this movie
miniseries.
Yeah, it starts off with David Soul's character. I forgot his name.
Ben Mayers.
Ben, yeah, and the boy is it?
Was it Richard or
no?
Oh, or was it? I'm not sure which character was the kid now.
I think it's Mike.
Mike.
They're
Mark.
In like
Lawrence. Lance
oh yeah, Mark. Mark. They're in like I got it in the notes. Exotico, Mexico, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting some holy water or something. They look at the thing and start shining. And they're like, they found us again. We got to move. So basically, you're like, wow, what are they running from? And it goes back to where Ben is he's an author, and he went back to Salem's Lot and. He's infatuated with this house on top of this hill. And he's like, I've been drawn here. Come to find out that there's a new man in town that is a business partner. I think his name's Streaker. And his business partner's, what's his name? Barlow?
Barlow.
Is it Barlow? The last guy you said? The guy that plays the Nosferatu character.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the name
Barlow.
Right now.
Yeah. Yeah, Barlow. So, but Barlow hasn't arrived yet, but he's setting up, like, this antique store and all that.
Kurt Barlow, sorry.
Yeah, so they're like, but Ben's wanting to buy the house, and they're like, hey, it's already been sold to this guy. They're taking care of it. And come to find out, strange things start happening in this town. Ever since Ben got there, like there's a dog that dies. I think one of the funniest scenes I can see me and Kyle doing this is where the two guys are instructed to go pick up this. Hey, do you want to make $50?
Yeah.
And they go pick up this gigantic crate. And he's like, man, it's cold to touch. It's cold to touch. We need to open it. He's like, no, we need to open it. And they put it in this truck. And he's like, it's moving. It's moving closer. He's like, something's not right. He's like, dude, we're just dropping it off and getting out of here. So they take it down to the cellar of the house. They're supposed to lock it up. They don't. And I'm going to ask this question to you right now, Kyle, because he specifically, Stryker specifically told them, hey, go buy these padlocks. Pad up the cellar door, the garage door, the front door, back door, and then throw the keys wherever he said.
Yeah.
Do you think if they would have locked that door to the cellar specifically, that the outbreak wouldn't have happened? Do you think Streaker was trying to prevent the outbreak from happening so quick?
Yeah, I think he was trying to keep the kind of like the hunger contained to a sustainable level, like some degree, like people wouldn't actually notice him or something like that too. But instead, everything kind of got out of hand really quick, where the entire town basically kind of collapsed under the reign of these vampires taking over the city, basically.
Well, no, they have rheumatoid fever or whatever.
Rheumatoid fever, yeah.
But basically, so Ben's like, look, what's going on? And he's, he you know, talks to the doctor, and you know, he's basically likes this girl who's been seeing this other guy, and the other guy beats him up, and it's just a lot. It's a lot of story going on here with sub stories, but I really enjoyed it. So let's talk a little bit about the
Well, Jim, I have a small confession to make because not very.
You didn't finish it. You didn't watch.
No, I did. I watched all of this. I watched all of this for sure. That's no problem. But I will say, I had no idea about vampires going into it. It was a surprise when it was just like the monster. Like I assumed some kind of prevailing evil or something like kind of like out of
when left did you realize it was King. A vampire movie?
Probably about halfway through, actually, where I realized like it was just straight up vampires.
Is it where the kid is like knocking on the window
through the door, and I was like, is this just straight up vampires? And like, sure enough, it is just straight up vampires. And I was like, because I'm kind of used to Stephen King's kind of doing stuff a little bit out of left field or customizing the monster to kind of be uniquely tailored to the story necessarily here. I didn't expect just a regular kind of very much of Nosferatu kind of style vampire movie the way they did in this film. I really appreciate it on that level, but I didn't expect that at all. I had no idea what I was going into for this film. So that was my
question. Oh, so you didn't see a trailer or read about it?
I didn't see a trailer, didn't read about the movie at all.
You just went off my recommendation.
I went off completely blind, just good. Like, let's watch Salem's Lot. I know what the
Stephen
King
And you enjoyed
King
it, did you?
I did.
All right, let's talk about some notes. Maybe it'll change your mind. No,
no, I hate this film. Worst thing ever made. Stephen King, eat your heart out.
Yeah, so here we go. Director George A. Romero was originally approached to direct a feature film version, but after the announcement of John Badham's Dracula and Werner Herzog's Nosferatu, the Vampire, Warner Brothers decided to turn Salem's Lot into a TV miniseries. Romero then said, I'm out.
Ain't for me.
Feeling he wouldn't be able to make the film the way he wanted to with the restrictions of network television.
That's fair enough. Even then, this one has a PG rating, so they kept it very close to their chest about any of the graphical effects at all. So
they did. The miniseries starts and ends at the small town of Ximico, Guatemala. So it wasn't Mexico, it was Guatemala. This town doesn't actually exist, so it's just completely made up town.
Fictional town.
Right.
Yeah. Best place to run away to.
Producer Richard Kobritz decided to select Toby Hooper for the director's chair after catching a screening of Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The exterior for the Marson house was actually a full-scale facade built upon a smaller pre-existing hilltop house. In total, the facade cost the production estimated $100,000 to build.
Oh, wow.
An entire house in 1979 could have been built for that amount
of money. Yeah.
They could have built a whole house. Sold it at the end and made more
money back, yeah. Wow. That's hilarious.
But that was also including the interiors of the house, not just the outside. It was the whole house.
Oh, yeah. So it would have been better when they just didn't make a profit. They should have just made an entire real house.
Right.
And film.
The last production that composer Harry Sukman worked on before his death in 1984, the score was nominated for an Emmy, as Kyle stated earlier.
A Primetime Emmy Award, yep.
In an interview with Fangoria magazine, Reggie Nalder, who played Barlow, said he was somewhat disappointed by the film because some additional scenes, including his vampire, were cut. So he's not in this movie very long at all. I think it's maybe
precious few minutes.
3 minutes, maybe?
Yeah.
I think it says in the notes.
Which is kind of like those surprising things, which like it's kind of a contradiction, but it's like it's always like the less you show of the monsters, the more imposing they always are.
I thought it was really well done.
Exactly. It's like kind of perfect, actually.
Yeah. I thought those little kids were scarier, especially the one where they're having his funeral and the groundskeeper starts throwing the dirt on there and jumps down in there and opens the lid and the kid's like in a top hat and a black suit.
Yeah.
And he's laying out, all of a sudden he just pops up and then it zooms in on his eyes and like, I'm like, oh man.
Yeah. This movie is kind of like a masterclass in kind of like the less is more kind of mentality when it comes to actual like violent scenes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
After the miniseries aired on CBS with excellent ratings, there was talk of continuing as a regular television series for a while, but it never materialized.
No, but of course we did get the films like Return to Salem's Lot and those kind of
right.
films.
But there is, as I was talking to Kyle, there is a reboot, if you will, or a remake of this coming out this year at some time, so be on the lookout for that. I think it's a TV show or a miniseries, one of the two.
Check it out.
Yeah, hopefully they stay true.
Yeah.
This was the first television miniseries and the second film to be based on the writings of author Stephen King.
Oh, one of the first?
It was the first television miniseries.
Oh, first television
But it was the
series,
second based. Film.
Yeah, okay. So second film, first, second. Okay, so wow. Very, very, very early in Stephen King's getting his adaptation work.
Right.
Yeah.
The title of the novel, Salem's Lot, includes an apostrophe in the front of the word Salem because the title is supposed to be short for Jerusalem's Lot, which we talked about earlier. The actual name of the town where the story is set. To avoid confusion for the miniseries adaptation, though the town is mostly referred to as Salem's Lot, and the first apostrophe was dropped from the film's title. The studio interiors for the Marston House cost the production $70,000 to construct. So there again.
Yeah, big money being spent on something.
You did this facade outside with a bunch of money. Another $70,000 here to do the inside. Well, you could have just built a house.
And sold it for probably more money than you built it for in the first place. But you could
have built one house and done whatever you wanted inside of it and then sold it.
Yeah.
So
this film comes off as incredibly wasteful in those regards.
Yes, very. In an interview with Reggie Nelder, the actor said that the contact lenses and heavy makeup work he had to wear for the role of Kurt Barlow was quite painful and took some time to get adjusted to, which he looked really good, though.
Mm-hmm. I think he looked great in this film.
In an interview with Dr. Tobe Hooper, Hooper said that the makeup work on Reggie Nelder, I think it's Nelder,
yeah,
had to be constantly touched up as it would crack or fall off while the actor was performing for the camera.
That's funny.
But I mean, practical makeup, you love it.
Yeah, yeah. Creates a look that just can't be replicated.
Though Salem's Lot was only Stephen King's second published novel, which I don't remember that being true, but I guess it is. Like many of his subsequent novels, it has connection to his Dark Tower series. In this case, the character of Father Donald Callahan appears in the later books of the series.
Oh, interesting.
The original novel established many motifs that Stephen King would use in his subsequent novels. It takes place in a small town in Maine, and many later stories took place in the small towns of Derry or Castle Rock. There's even a TV show of that. It features a much larger cast of characters than Carrie did, and most of his later books had a large cast. The main character, Ben Mears, is a professional writer, and another major character, Matt Burke, is a school teacher. Many of his subsequent characters were either or both. Stephen King himself also had held both jobs. So yeah. He was an author and a teacher.
Yeah, Stephen King definitely likes his self-insert characters very much. He's very kind to them, as well as small towns, of course, for the exact same reason.
Yep. Stephen King was inspired to write the book when he had his English class read Dracula and became curious about what would happen if vampires came to America, specifically to a small town. The scenes of child vampires floating outside of their victims' windows was partially filmed in reverse to give it more eerie effect. Additionally, the actors performed on a boom crane instead of being suspended by wires. Creepy, man.
It works.
And I like how the fog rolled in with them, too. It was just...
Yeah. It's
the tapping on the window, the scratching and tapping on the window. It's just... You watch that at night, it's kind of creepy.
You get the vibes. Yeah.
Although this adaptation differs dramatically in a lot of different areas from the novel, notably in the depiction of Chief Vampire Mr. Barlow, Stephen King approved of it. James Mason jumped at the chance of playing a servant of evil, loving the script. This was fortunate as he was producer Richard Corbett's first choice for the role of Mr. Straker. In October of 2013, so not that long ago, about 11 years ago, Entrada Records released a 2-CD set of the complete film score with alternate cues for the edited version of the film, which were re-recorded for said edit in stereo, making the world premiere release of the score. So that'd be cool to find. Maybe it's on Apple Music.
I think compliment of the score is that I don't feel like I really notice it in the film, but I feel like it worked perfectly well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Psycho writer Robert Block was originally supposed to perform scripting duties, which... I can only imagine how good
this
that
is. This is the
would
writer for a psycho. He's not a psycho writer. That's a different guy.
Oh, man. Yeah. He's not the psycho. This was the second vampire-themed TV production for David Soul. The first was a season 2 episode of Starsky and Hutch entitled The Vampire. It dealt with a psychopath who drained the blood of his victims in an attempt to resurrect his dead wife.
We've all been there.
Wow. Jonathan Davis, the lead singer of the band Korn, has mentioned this as one of his favorite horror movies. The map of Salem's Lot and Crockett's real estate office resembles the city of New Orleans.
So you might say that's loosely based where it's supposed to be kind of based in actually New Orleans overall, too. You always put creepy stuff in New Orleans. It works fine.
Especially during Mardi Gras, is that what you're
exactly,
saying?
Exactly, yeah.
Actors Elisha Cook Jr. and Mary Windsor were cast as husband and wife in Salem's Lot as a reference to the 1956 film The Killing, where they also played husband and wife.
That's really cool.
So that's pretty cool. Bonnie Bedelia's character teaches at Holly Junior High. Holly was her character's name in the first Die Hard.
Mm-hmm.
Reggie Nelder, who plays the master vampire Kurt Barlow, has less than 90 seconds of screen time.
90 seconds
of screen time.
So little.
In the full 3-hour miniseries. 90 seconds. But you know, it says Nelder was less than impressed with this. But let me tell you something: those 90 seconds are probably the most memorable of the whole movie. Especially the one where he's in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Remember when they streaker?
He's like Mark Hamill in The Force Awakens.
No, Mark had more screen time, I think.
So I wouldn't be surprised.
Reggie Nalder was later mentioned as having once played a vampire in Stephen King's 1986 novel It. So that's funny.
A small world after all.
The biggest issue that divides fans of the novel and miniseries is the fact that Barlow is depicted as a hissing Nosferatu-like monster in the adaptation, as opposed to the speaking Dracula-like character of the novel. In an interview with Richard Kobritz, he said the decision to go with the terrifying monster figure came out of concerns that a speaking, romanticized villain just wouldn't be frightening enough, especially as John Badham's remake of Dracula, starring Frank LaGuardia, was released in 1979. Stephen King was against the change at first, but after he saw the footage, he thought it may help the audience focus more on the main characters.
I'm a little bit conflicted about it, too, because I really do feel like the Nosferatu kind of vampire kind of gets underrepresented a little bit, because, like, I like the idea of just a disturbing creature of the night kind of thing, versus the kind of the infinite seducer, romanceful vampires of the kind of, like, modern age right now. There's too many romanceful zombies. I want more Nosferatu, just like, oh, this is evil and disgusting, and just like a draining thing, you know, that makes it a lot more frightening. I feel like sometimes Nosferatu works for me.
Right.
Yeah.
While the killing of Mike Ryerson's dog is never explained, I know Kyle probably had a problem with the dog killing. The tombstone above it says Marston. This implies the dog may have been a sacrifice of some kind to the spirit of Hubie Marston, Salem's Lot's most notorious former resident. And the 2004 adaptation makes it clear that the killing of the dog in the cemetery meant that the cemetery was no longer hallowed ground. It would therefore have to be re-consecrated or made sacred again.
Oh, so that's the reason why.
All right, Kyle. That's all the notes there was. There wasn't much on it, but I think when you have a miniseries like this, there's going to be less notes, but the story sticks with you. So let's hear what you have to say.
Jim, I think I feel pretty favorably with it overall. I think it actually stands up really, really well, and it's probably worth watching. I think I've had the choice of going to watch it now. I'd probably watch it in the episode format versus this giant compressed miniseries into one movie kind of thing like that, because it is incredibly long. But if I watched it as like a 3 or 4 episode miniseries, I'd probably enjoy it more. So I think its intended format, it works better in anyways. And overall, I think this is probably a strong 7 for me overall. I enjoyed it. I think it's a solid vampire flick. At the same time, I feel like it never went like too far with me. I think like it's kind of restraining that TV and PG rated kind of constraints where I don't feel like it really excited me to any real degree. But I think it works well for what it is. So I feel pretty favorably with it. I think this is really good, verging on great overall. And I might rewatch it sometime again in the future. But overall, I think it's just solid, good work, a good vampire story, and Stephen King should be proud of his work here, as well as all of the people that made this production possible. So overall, excellent. Excellent is probably the word for it. Excellent. 7 out of 10. Excellent for me. I enjoy it. Well worth watching, especially if you're a vampire fan. So I recommend it. Jimbo, how do you feel about this? More favorably or less?
I'm probably going to give it an 8 out of 10. Mm-hmm. I think this is the epitome of less is more.
I can definitely see that.
It's kind of like a whodunit. It's kind of like a mystery. You don't know exactly what's going on. And you know, the one thing that I didn't really understand, or they never really explained, was Streaker. He's very powerful. Mm-hmm. If you watch the end of the movie where he picks up the guy that's with him going into the house, he picks him up and he throws him on the antlers.
Yeah.
I mean, because if he was a vampire, he wouldn't be allowed out in the daylight. So he wasn't a vampire.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure. They never really went in to explain what he was. And maybe he just worked out.
I think I'll say too, I think like, for me, I kind of felt like the same kind of vibe of mystery and confusion that I kind of felt when I was watching Phantasm for the first time. I'm doing that podcast, and same like without the same rough edges of like, you know, one, all the gruesome violence and disgusting kind of things like defecation stuff like that going on there too. So if anything, this makes it kind of an easier watch on that level too. So I appreciate it on that level as well. But I felt a similar kind of level of just like, yeah, the confusion of who done it and what's actually going on here in this town, and then finding out the real revelation that it's vampires instead of astral aliens. Well, wasn't Phantasm.
And here's another issue that I don't know if I really understood.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, Mark and Ben set the house on fire. And I thought that was a really cool scene. Once they hammer away and they kill the Barlow, where those two or three vampires are crawling towards the kid, remember?
Yeah.
In the background, you just, because he hits that light and it's swinging, and every time the light would swing back, they would be closer.
That was such a good shot.
And so basically he shuts that, he locks it. And of course, Susan, was her name Susan, I think, she was still in the house too when they set it on fire. Now, Kyle, the vampire lore is there's ways to kill vampires by driving a stake through their heart,
burning them, and also
burning them.
Yeah.
And
holy water and things like that. Yeah.
So my question is, the ending of this movie, if we go on that logic, doesn't make sense because he says, oh, there'll be others that come after us, right?
Yeah.
And that they have to stay on the run. When you're watching the house burn, there's a scene where like one of the windows is smashed open, if you pay attention. My question to you is, logically, should have Susan, is her name Susan? Am I saying that right?
It's Susan Norton.
Shouldn't she have perished in the fire instead of being at the very end of this movie? Or do you think that she wasn't fully turned yet? You remember how the kid would get bit and then he was in the hospital and the kid came back to him in the hospital to finish him off.
You can always contrive excuses for how she could have survived, like kind of thing, like the building collapsing and then somehow saving her in the collapse, something like that too, or firefighters coming in and staving off the fire enough where Susan survived it, or somehow she escaping the facility, or escaping the house overall. So like you can make an excuse why Susan could have made it out and survived long enough to become a full vampire and then chase them down. I think another reading is that like, to an extent, I don't think it's ever clear that they truly succeeded in their goal of, like, stopping the plague from continuing to spread going forward, and that's kind of why they're on the run, too. I think you could almost do a reading of the thing where, like, the world is being overtaken by vampirism going forward, and that's why they have to continue to be on the run for as long as they are.
You know what that means?
What's that?
We got to do Return to Salem's Lot now.
To get
see if it answers any of these questions.
About that too,
because I don't think I've ever seen the sequel, The Return to Salem's Lot, or whatever it is.
But I feel like a few stories have done it. I can't remember the one where Sam Neill was in one of them, where the entire world was overtaken by vampires. But I like the idea of like as soon as vampires start spreading, the cat's really out of the bag at that point. You've kind of opened Pandora's box where, like, as soon as something like that overtakes the world, you can't stop it. It's just that's it. It is a doomsday scenario for many people in a reality sense of being able to spread a disease of that kind of power. And I like that kind of idea in storytelling. And I feel like, to a degree, the ending of this miniseries movie kind of implies that to me at the very end. So we may have watched the sequel sometime to see what they really did with it, but to me, that's what it kind of felt like. That's why you got to stay on the run, because vampires, as soon as they're awakened, you can't unawake them. You know, you can't put that genie back in the bottle. It's as bad as it gets, and it's only going to get worse.
Unless we're like Colin from What We Do in the Shadows, that is the emotional. The emotional training vampire.
I love the idea of also of bored vampires. It's like I don't really care about infecting people. I get hungry on occasion, but really I'm just bored 90% of the time. I'm basically at 400 years old. I forgot everything I knew. So hilarious. I love What We Do in the Shadows is great.
Overall, it's an 8 out of 10. Definitely a must watch. If you want to break it down into, I broke it down into like half hour segments, like at work, I'd watch it on break or, you know, half
probably
hour.
Probably the best way to do it, really.
And that way it always kept my mind turning of what's coming next. So, definitely a good miniseries.
I wouldn't recommend it for one sitting, but I do recommend it as a Stephen King or a vampire fan for sure.
Absolutely. So if you'd like to follow us, we are the Tragedy of Cinema Podcast on Facebook. Join the group. Have a lot of fun. If you want to reach out, we are the Tragedy of Cinema @gmail.com. You can leave us if you want us to do a movie, make a suggestion. We will put it on the list. If you'd like to buy some merchandise, Kyle, where can they find that at?
Oh, my gosh. Where do you have the merchandise post, Jimbo?
I don't know. That's why I asked you.
No, I have no idea. I don't know the exact link to say now.
What's it called?
Edit in the show notes and add to it.
T something.
It's
been a minute since I've been on there, but I have to order some. So
we'll have to re-add this link now. We're such good promoters of our work.
I mean, I know there was always a Redbubble or whatever.
Yeah, there was Redbubble for a while, but I'm not sure we get the right link.
And then we moved over to T Public, I believe,
where we have the Tragedy of Cinema stuff on there.
Yeah, so you can find our logo, and you can also find we have one with ADZ and I in our Twilight Zone shirts thing. So
yeah.
I'll put something on Facebook about it. Usually they have some good sales on there. So if you want to promote the show, if you'd like to leave us a review, we do read them on the air, good, bad, or rotten.
Yeah,
we have a lot of fun interacting with our listeners too, and absolutely. Also
we love fan requests for sure.
Be on the lookout because more information will be coming about our live show October 26th at the Boone County Jail and Distillery. Again, we got some really excited stuff starting to be planned out and mapped out. So I can't wait to share with you guys what we're going to be doing. We're doing something a little different this year, where we'll be showing multiple movies at multiple times. Maybe starting a little earlier so the kids can come in, catch a little movie, and then go out to trick-or-treating on the town square, which was really overwhelming last time that we were there because there were so many kids and so many people. It was amazing. But we had just enough candy, which was also amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing, we had just enough candy.
I bought three bags. I said, well, I bought three bags or whatever, and we had just enough. So we look forward to doing that again. So. But that's enough rambling. With that being said, I think this episode's coming to a close, and that's a wrap.
And cut. I have a thirst for blood.